Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702 for the curious on 92.7 and 106 FM.
Welcome to The Money Show, brought to you by Nedbank. Looking at money from every angle leads to better money decisions. See money differently. Nedbank. The sun is set over South Africa this evening. The IEC Election Centre, The Rock, the Results Operating Centre at the Pretoria Showgrounds is coming to life. Politicians, lots of famous faces are beginning to descend on The Rock as they watch very nervously at the state of play on the election tally boards. About 8.5 million votes are counted so far. It's 55% of the total that were cast, and the lie of the land is pretty clear. We'll talk to Ralph Matejo, political analyst, about that in just a moment. We'll also talk about social media, its role in these elections, and the distortions on social media that don't play out in the real world. Thank goodness. I have some of the loudest social media players making the biggest noise about unfair elections as they'd get consigned to the dustbin of electoral history. And that is entirely possible. We'll also this evening talk to our renegade economist, Anti Pai, about the Reserve Bank. We'll get a good perspective on what now for your money with Warren Ingram and two great entrepreneurs this evening filling our small business feature. That is all coming up tonight on The Money Show. But first, let's give away 2,000 Rand coming up in the next 20 minutes. Your chance to win 2,000 Rand in cash, courtesy of 702 Cape Talk and Altron, there when it matters. Your fast fact question this evening, and I've very cunningly misplaced the fast fact question this evening. There it is. Which mining company is the first South African company to list on the New York Stock Exchange? It did so in August 1998. A South African company, the first one ever. This is a higher grade question for you this evening. Mining company, the first South African company to list on the New York Stock Exchange in August 1998. It's a tricky one, so we'll take answer number, what's the date today? It's the 9th. It's the day after the elections. Correct answer number 9. How's that for science? I could become a data scientist. I'm learning lots about data science at the IEC Results Center. 31702, 31567, the first mining company to list on the New York Stock Exchange, August 1998. I'd like to know the name of that company, please, on 31702 and 31567. We'll give away that 2,000 Rand just before 6:30.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield. Live, online, smartphones, DSTV, and 92.7 and 106 FM.
Political analyst Ralph Matejo in studio with us at The Rock this evening. No big surprises, no big shocks. ANC shrinking, EFF growing, DA slipping, Freedom Front Plus escalating quite dramatically from where it was, from a low base. You need a microphone to be switched on for you to talk to me, Ralph. I mean, come on, you've done this before.
Thanks, Bruce. Well, I haven't done this at The Rock recently, but I fully agree with what you are saying. There is no rocking the boat here when it comes to what happened among the top three parties here. The ANC dipping below 60%. The EFF seems to be growing, but I would say it's a mediocre growth, way lower than the exaggeration that they've made in the social media about their growth prospects. The DA seems to be stranded in the middle of the ANC and the EFF. Whether the DA is coming or going seems to be stagnant, actually.
Is the Freedom Front's growth sort of a rebellion by more conservative elements within the Democratic Alliance, perhaps people who are looking for somebody to fight harder on land for them, potentially, to go to the Freedom Front Plus, which has almost quadrupled its support?
I really think it is a response to the EFF, more of a response to the radicalism of the EFF that is positions on the left than being, a response to actually the DA. Of course, those that are not satisfied with the DA's position as an opposition, the type of opposition that the DA seems to be pushing. I would imagine that those who might have left the DA to the Freedom Front Plus, I don't think that is a significant number anyway. We will see. But I think that, be that as it may, those who left the Freedom Front, or who left the DA to Freedom Front Plus, it's more about going to an opposition that is well-positioned and very clear. You know what the Freedom Front Plus say about BEE. They don't like it. They don't like affirmative action. It's not about saying, let's implement it better and all that. Whereas the DA, unfortunately, has been quite cantankerous going into this election. They've been flip-flopping. They cannot even handle the race debate very well. So I think that they come across as very unclear. Yeah.
very few firm policy positions. That's because the moment you have a firm policy position, you open yourself to be torn down on that firm policy position. So it's quite a dangerous place to go. When we look at the way things stand at the moment, 55% of the votes in, do you anticipate any major shifts where the percentages are sitting at the moment? Roughly 57 for the ANC, roughly 22 for the DA, under 10 for the EFF?
I really don't see a major shift from what is already there. I mean, Bruce, I've thought before, I've believed more in the idea that the ANC will be reduced to below that 60%, the EFF itself, when it comes to the growth, of course, I've thought that they will go to that 10%. They will try to nudge that 10%. If they cross that 10%, the EFF, I don't think it will be far outside that. And I think it's a good achievement for them.
How many seats do parties need at these elections? Relatively low turnout. We don't have the exact numbers yet, but we get a sense. That's what, 63 or 64% voter turnout, which is low. Last time around, you needed what, 45,000?
45,000. Now, with a lower turnout, it means the waiting is a little bit lower. The waiting of the percentage will be a little bit lower. That means 35,000, maybe up to 40 or just below that, can actually get you a seat.
That opens the way still for COPE to get a seat, the UDM to get a seat. I mean, they may get two each. COPE is taking a blood nose at these elections. The ATM, that's Mzwanele Manyi, he's the most famous member of that party. I don't think he's number one on the list, but they've just been celebrating a probable seat. It's going to be an interesting parliament.
It's going to be an interesting parliament, but I also think that small parties such as your COPE, such as your AHANG, they're always facing a risk by the newer one that are coming. You know, South Africa's electoral experience is such that newer parties tend to be more welcome, especially newer, smaller ones. And those that have been there usually have a very bad record in maintaining what they have. So we might see some exits.
Ralph Matecha, thank you very much indeed. Political analyst Ralph Matecha this evening on The Money Show. Dr. Vukosi Marivate is a visiting data scientist at the CSIR. The data, if you'd lived on social media in the 3 months before the elections, the results would be a big shock to you, because the reality of elections and the reality of social media are fundamentally different things.
I think people shouldn't take social media as actually representing really what's going on the ground. We actually then took a look at over the last few weeks where the especially on Twitter, where people were tweeting from. One of the things you should understand is, like, okay, one, very few people actually switch on their location anyway when they're sharing information. And then two, depending on the connectivity in the country, there's going to be now, this distortion that happens in there. So very easily in South Africa, Twitter is mostly represented in Gauteng. If you look at the top areas, it's always going to Johannesburg and Pretoria. So now when you're looking at that and saying, like, hey, Party X and Party Y, here's how much support they have online, who actually are those people?
There's a disproportionate amount. The empty vessels make the loudest noise, and that plays out in social media.
I wouldn't necessarily say so, because in some ways it is about who then uses social media as their main kind of marketing tool.
If you look at social media as a marketing tool and the way social media has played out in the real world, social media is not a great marketing tool. If you're the BLF, you're going to look at your 6,000 or 7,000 votes at the halfway point to be quite disappointed with your performance, maybe even start calling electoral fraud.
So what happens is that there's always going to be this concept of, like, you know, either moving things. What has the biggest impact? Is it the things that are slow, so meaning going door to door, or these things that look like they're fast and they give you this instant high of, like, oh, we can see this reaction? And here I think it's showing that if you really want to do well in elections, the slow has to be there.
Absolutely. I mean, what have you learned from the social media experience versus what the reality is telling us South Africans actually do think when it comes to putting across on the ballot paper?
For us, it's been very interesting looking at, especially over the last 12 hours. So when the results started coming in, we shifted yesterday from, it was like SA elections 2019 was the top hashtag, and now it's elections results. And then, like, you know, before EFF was the topic maker. Now they still are the topic maker today, but it really changed to, oh, the EFF is not doing as well as what people were expecting.
And suddenly the Freedom Front Plus started trending.
Yes.
Maybe because it's like, who are these people?
People are still asking the questions of actually what does it mean? Does it mean that DA lost votes to the Freedom Front Plus, or the Freedom Front Plus took some votes from all the other smaller parties? From social media, we really can't get to that. But we are seeing a lot of, as I say, like the activities is actually about the EFF over the last 12 hours.
Vukosi, thank you very much indeed. Dr. Vukosi Marivate, the visiting data scientist at the CSIR, painting the picture very clearly for us that social media world is not reality. Thank goodness we now have that as fact. On to Philip De Wet now. And Philip is the associate editor at Business Insider, doing an in-depth story today on the mystery of the electoral ink. Philip De Wet, tell us what you managed to find out.
Hello, Bruce. Not as much as we would like to find out, unfortunately. We know that the indelible ink, or the supposedly indelible ink, was bought from a Bidvest subsidiary. We know that Bidvest isn't talking to us about that, and we expressed very clearly our displeasure with Bidvest about this. The IEC hasn't said a lot yet either. So we know that this Bidvest company sold these pens to the IEC. We know that the IEC paid around 2.7 million rand for the full set of pens. Works out to about 16 rand a pen. Other than that, we can only speculate. One of the things that we can speculate on is whether the formulation, which is strictly secret, of this ink was not right, and that caused the problems, or whether something else entirely went wrong. We have speculation that these pens might have been imported. No one can tell us that yet. We know that in certain, if you store them incorrectly, you can run into trouble. But neither the IEC nor its supplier are giving us more information.
I'm told on this side, talking to IEC staffers, that they're getting full cooperation from Lithotech, which is the company within the Bidvest stable, that everybody wants to get this matter resolved as quickly as possible. They're going to be doing limited audits on voting stations where they fear there may have been some double or triple or quadruple voting. The big concern is whether or not there was enough silver nitrate in the ink. Silver nitrate is supposed to be this special bonding agent that makes it more stable and indelible, which clearly we can't call them indelible ink pens because they're not indelible.
Well, yeah, the experts tell us that what you really want is about a 13% silver nitrate in your composition. Now, again, the formulation is secret by design. When the IEC put out its tender for these pens back in 2017, it actually said this must be a secret formulation so that it can't easily be replicated. You know, you can see the point in that. However, we know that silver nitrate is an important component, and we know that silver nitrate is a relatively expensive component. Some of the people that I've spoken to today who deal with these matters say they looked at the price that Lithotech offered, the 16 Rand odd a pen, and they can't quite see how you can make that happen. So, again, we have no idea. I mean, it's entirely possible that the pens that the Bidvest subsidiary delivered were working fine, that they were replaced in the warehouse, that they were incorrectly stored, something else could have gone wrong. But with the limited information that we have available at the moment, the experts are saying, we look at that price, we look at the requirement for silver nitrate, and we worry that the IEC bought too cheaply and that these things didn't work as they were supposed to.
Philip De Wet, thank you. Associate Editor at Business Insider, thank you very much. The great mystery of the pens. Bidvest referred us to the IEC. The IEC says they're talking to Bidvest. We wait for clarity.
The Money Show. The Markets.
Graham Kerner with the Kerner Perspective. What a big sell-off on the JSE. It seemed disproportionate to what's going on elsewhere in the world, Graham Kerner, where we saw Asia, the Asian markets setting the tone every day, going into the red, Europe going into the red, the US beginning that cycle all over again. But the JSE underperformed by a country mile, down more than 1,500 points on the day. We got a big smack at lots of SA Inc. companies falling out of favor later on in the afternoon.
Yeah, Bruce, I think the sell-off later in the day really compounded the losses. But I think the reality is, while we were all voting yesterday, world markets were soggy, so we had a bit of catch-up to play. And then, you know, as you say, I mean, China down today 1.9% makes our 2.8 or thereabouts look worse. But I think we were just playing catch-up because we were out of action for a day.
Okay, so it still is in relation then to global factors rather than local factors. In fact, the currency is better off today than it was on Monday. The bond market is reflecting lots of calm attitudes towards South Africa's election results. This is an election that markets are taking in their stride.
Yeah, Bruce, I think most people in the market sort of felt that the ANC would get between 55 and 60. I think probably the big disappointment so far is, well, not disappointment, but surprise, is the fact that the EFF hasn't breached 10%. I think a lot of people were expecting them to gain
there's
more
traction. There's still time, Graham. We're 58% of the way through the vote, as I see on the big screen in front of me. There's still time. They're on 843,000 votes. The DA is nearing 2 million, and the ANC nearing 5 million in total.
So I think, Bruce, a few shifts, but the big theme is one of probably, in spite of a lost decade, I think people saying this is a vote of confidence in President Ramaphosa to get the country back on track and to drive home the policy changes that are necessary. So, as you say, I think look to the bond market for guidance on what's happening. And I think the 10-year sitting at 8.55 when I left the office ran 1441, 1442, bearing in mind, you know, all of this is what's happening in our market is a function of you know, almost panic in global markets, courtesy of a really big fight going on between China and the US, and of course tomorrow's D-Day for those talks. So I think emerging markets are being hit hard. So the fact that we're actually from a currency and a bond market point of view, holding our ground, I think is probably good news and more of a reflection of the way people really feel about South Africa Incorporated than what we're seeing in the equity market.
I saw The Economist, Avi Root, tweeting today that the outcome of this election is about as good as one can hope for in South Africa, from it being market neutral, even market positive, and maybe even good for the macro economy over time.
Absolutely right. I think a lot of people felt that you know, if the ANC came in closer to 50 rather than 55 or towards 60, it would maybe undermine the mandate for President Ramaphosa. And I think the fact that they're sort of currently sitting at 56 and have been there pretty much through the day, it's almost like it was according to script. I think the market is probably agreeing with Davi in that this is probably as good as it gets. Whether you're supportive or not, I think from a market's point of view and a ratings agency point of view, this is business as usual. It's a continuation of a theme. And hopefully, as I said, it gives the president the mandate he needs to drive home those policy changes and hopefully restructure a cabinet and hopefully, you know, maybe a 20 or 25-person cabinet.
Graham Kohner with the Kohner Perspective. Thank you, Graham. Summarizing today's market activity, a big drop on the JSE, but markets playing catch-up on yesterday's public holiday. A quick fast fact. I asked you in the fast fact question, I said, which mining company was the first to list on the New York Stock Exchange in August 1998? Doreen in Tokai was through ninth. Doreen, what is the answer, please?
It's Anglo Gold Ashanti.
Anglo Gold Ashanti, absolutely right, Doreen and Takai. Well done to you. 2,000 Rand will find its way to you. Well done to Doreen on 31567 in Cape Town, 31702 in Joburg. The fast fact with Altron, I asked which company it was. It was, in fact, Anglo Gold. Anglo American started reducing its stake in Anglo Gold Ashanti in April 2006. And today, Anglo Gold Ashanti, reflecting its last asset in South Africa, the Mponeng mine near Carletonville, is on the market. It's the end of an era in South Africa in terms of mining. The Anglo association with gold in South Africa, upon which it was built along with diamonds, will soon be no longer. Well done to Doreen and Takai. 2,000 Rand in cash, courtesy of 702 Cape Talk and Altron, there when it matters. And listen to the show again tomorrow when I'm going to have 4,000 Rand in the Brutal Biz Quiz to give away tomorrow.
The Money Show is brought to you by Nedbank. Looking at money from every angle leads to better money decisions. See money differently. Nedbank.
Well, Woolworth's long-running love affair with Marks and Spencer continuing. There's a deep connection, and I haven't been able to put it together, really, between the Sussman family and Marks and Spencer going back decades. Producers, we need to talk to Simon Sussman at some point and understand that legacy. I think it's a very interesting family connection, somehow, going back decades to Marks and Spencer. But interesting today to see Woolworths, the South African company, appointing a former Marks and Spencer style director, a person by the name of Belinda Earle, to its board as a non-executive. Now, Belinda Earle is a British fashion expert. Her input is desperately needed at Woolworths. So many of its customers believe it's lost the plot on fashion and basics. And you hope that somebody like a Belinda Earle can come into the boardroom and shake things up on that particular front. Certainly things being shaken up at the IEC Centre, where 58% of votes have been tallied so far. The ANC is a whisker away from 5 million votes. The DA is a little bit further away from 2 million, and the EFF is sitting just over 850,000. They are the primary winners. The Good Party sitting on 50,000 in the national vote. I can't see the regional boards. They are just too far away, and I don't have binoculars. But the DA is certainly very much in the driving seat in the Western Cape. So it's going to make an interesting play on the national stage. The smaller political parties, the BLFs of the world and others, are kicking a stink over process and procedure and fairness. We'll see whether or not they've got the gumption to go to court over these election results. Daniel Silk is political economy analyst at the Political Futures Consultancy on the line to us from Cape Town. What does South Africa's political future look like, Daniel Silk, with nearly 60% of the votes counted?
Hello, Bruce. Yeah, look, I think the election is running sort of true to form, as one might say. What I think is that, we are seeing a marginally softer result for the ANC. It's down from its 2014 election result, but it is also up from the 2016 local government result. So there is a degree of turnaround for the ANC. I think the most important issue here is that if the ANC remains on 57% or just under 58%, where I expect it to lie, the ANC has lost its cushion. It's lost the fat that it has. It's no longer above 62%. It's down 5% or thereabouts. And that really puts pressure on Ramaphosa to perform over the next 5 years or so. This is an election result in which the pressure is going to be felt by the ANC at national level. It's going to be felt certainly by the DA, given a softer result for it nationally and a better result for it in the Western Cape. And the pressure is on that party as well. And indeed, for that matter, the EFF will also face some pressure in trying to take advantage of both of those two parties. It's an election about pressure, and that's going to be felt.
Now, who's going to be most disappointed? ANC, EFF, DA? None of them performing to their own level of expectation, I don't think.
Well, we're going to hear some good spin, I think, coming out from all of them to tell you how well they've all done. I think the most disappointed on the national level will certainly be the DA if it fails to grow. And I think significantly for the DA, it has made a big deal about being the party that continues to grow at each and every election. This could very well stunt its national growth. On the other hand, of course, the party has pulled itself back from the brink in the Western Cape, where it was a year ago, not looking as though it would get 50%. It's done remarkably well to claw on to what will be a fairly decent victory in the province. But I think that for the ANC itself, again, that luxury of being over 60% will unnerve some ANC members, especially as we move towards local government elections in just over 2 years. Remember, this is just a prelude for another round of elections, and an ANC under pressure, a DA feeling pressure as well, an EFF with momentum behind it, and really is going to set the scene for an exciting political 2 years, whether you want to be part of it or not.
I mean, but here's an interesting point. I mean, the EFF is, I think, always boxed way above its weight. It's always anticipated it's going to do far better than it has done. One wonders whether or not it's a time for political re-strategizing by not only the ANC, which has got the national, which has to have the national interest at heart. But when it comes to opposition politics, the DA is going to need to rethink the way it operates. It hasn't made gains as it has incrementally at every single election since 1994. This will be the first one where potentially it shows some slippage, and the EFF isn't making the massive gains that it had anticipated. It's growing and growing better than COPE and the UDM, for example, have done over time. But they must be worried about their lack of traction, certainly from what they may have anticipated for their own performance.
Well, I certainly agree with you that this election was the perfect opportunity for opposition parties to score very, very big, and they haven't necessarily scored that big, particularly the DA. And I think fingers are going to be pointed nationally, and they're probably going to be pointed around the national leader, to be perfectly honest. But the DA also found itself in a squeeze. Its more conservative or more right-wing voters on the flank decided to ditch it for the Freedom Front Plus. And I think if you took that additional vote for the Freedom Front Plus and you added it on to the existing DA vote, you'd probably get more or less a static vote for the DA or even a marginally increased DA vote. So that's really where the DA lost ground. The EFF did grow, and I don't think one should necessarily underestimate that level of growth South Africa is not a country in which political parties grow dramatically. We've seen incremental declines, incremental steps of growth. And so the EFF to go from 6.5% to probably what will be around 10% or so by the time the weekend comes is no mean feat. It's significant for them. And taking a party from nowhere into double figures over the course of 5-6 years or so, I think does show momentum in the opposition benches is with the EFF. And I tell you, Bruce, the ANC is going to have to decide, who does it listen to? Does it listen to the moderates to take South Africa forward in terms of economic policy, or does it listen to the populists? Because many in the ANC are going to be worried about encroachment of the EFF, especially in those local government elections I've spoken about.
It would seem that your bet is that the ANC is going to be more concerned about the EFF as a minority opposition party versus a majority opposition party in the DA.
I think it's going to cause a degree of consternation and possibly ructions in the ANC as they grapple exactly how to deal with the opposition party that has the greater momentum. But having said that, the DA is still going to be a party which will be virtually double the size, if not more, than the EFF. And if Ramaphosa can, in fact, moderate the broader tone within the ANC, you do have a combination of 58% ANC, 21% DA as the moderate centrists in South African politics. If that particular line can be, I think, agreed to by those two major parties, there's still room, I think, for the vast majority of South Africans, nearly 80% of them, who have voted, I believe, for more moderate leadership into the future.
Do we see the top three political parties retaining their current leadership for at least the foreseeable future, called foreseeable 2 years?
Well, I think the DA is the one that's going to have some introspection as to what happened on the national vote. And I think the party is going to be quite harsh in terms of leadership. I think the big problem for the DA, of course, is what is the succession stakes within the party? Mr. Maimane perhaps has a fairly clear line for the moment, but I think it won't be so easy for them. For the ANC, I think that President Ramaphosa will feel relatively confident that he's arrested the decline in the ANC. That will give him some leeway, I think, to begin or at least attempt some series of reforms going forward. And Mr. Malema, I think, will take this naturally as a solid show of support for the EFF, and I think his leadership will be pretty solid within the party for the foreseeable future.
Daniel Silk, thank you very much. From the Political Futures Consultancy, the political economy analyst, Daniel Silk.
702. Bruce is on Twitter at Bruce Business.
Welcome to The Money Show. Kanti Pai, the economist and founder at Nascence Advisory, our renegade economist feature, the threat to Reserve Bank independence. Do you think that's further away now, or is it coming closer as we see the sort of political landscape staying pretty much as it has been for quite a while, Kanti?
Look, Bruce, I think that this is a discussion that maybe actually builds on several problems in the sense that of course, I suppose now with the reduced majority, the ANC is probably not likely to be able to do anything, I guess, in terms of changing the constitution with respect to the Reserve Bank. But I think the big talk about it, though, is actually going to do a lot more harm than actually any kind of, political machinations could do. I mean, this idea of keep talking and over around the threat to the Reserve Bank actually will make sure that by the time this Reserve Bank governor leaves, that the next one is actually suffers credibility problems, because it will start to look like the ANC or a political party has actually taken over the Reserve Bank. And so it's almost like we are setting up now for a kind of public protector, Mkhwebane kind of situation, in which there's just not going to be anybody good enough after this governor.
But
if
who
we continue
benefits?
This way.
Who benefits from a weakened Reserve Bank? I mean, the Reserve Bank is the bedrock of the economy. The Reserve Bank is stability. Lesetša Ganyago, governor of the year, as judged by other Reserve Bank governors around the globe. The Reserve Bank has always been seen at the center of stability and solidity in South Africa.
Absolutely. And it's actually very difficult to see, because all of us have accepted that that the shares of the Reserve Bank don't have any influence on its policy making. So now everything else that has been discussed is speculation. So that actually, in the real sense, this governor, as we know, obviously has been elected by the ANC, in terms of ANC government at least, so that actually there's nobody there who would benefit as far as we know. And that, I think part of the problem also is the things we don't know. And remember, the credibility of the Reserve Bank really relies on full information, that we know what is going on. And it seems to me maybe there's something that maybe the governor himself or the people who continue to speak about this or speculate about this actually know something we don't know. And that transparency being worn down will also add to the problem. So I think the future of the Reserve Bank, if we continue to speculate the way we do without any information in terms of who, as the question you ask, Bruce, who would benefit is the big problem.
I've had it put to me that shareholders in the Reserve Bank, there's some shareholders who would like to see the private, the nationalization of the Reserve Bank, because the shares are worth very, very little money until you want to nationalize it, until you want to take it out of private shareholders' hands. There are people who have got shares in the Reserve Bank who would love to spare the state to pay them some money to take them out, away from them. I mean, that's feasible. That's the only possible beneficiary I could see out of this. Whether you, the government nationalizes the Reserve Bank or not, doesn't have a direct impact on policy. It's all about the independence of the Reserve Bank and its monetary governor and the Monetary Policy Committee. As long as those people are good, solid and reliable citizens, then everything is fine. There's got to be a financial element to this.
Absolutely, and I think that's right. I mean, we know we've got all those billions and billions in reserves, and whenever they report, they'll tell us about the net assets of the Reserve Bank. So I guess in that sense, that would be the only people who benefit. So then again, you know, then why is this talk about the credibility of policy, whether or not the Reserve Bank itself and its policy making is under threat? That's the big problem that I think we should actually be very careful about how we continue to address it. I mean, the governor keeps going on overseas trips, and we've heard even in, on CNN where they're saying, you know, the Reserve Bank itself is under attack. This is not helpful at all if we actually want to keep this institution.
Ultimately, government determines the mandate of the Reserve Bank. National Treasury determines the mandate. I worry about red herrings when it comes to the Reserve Bank. We're being fed lots of bulldust, and we're like mushrooms being fed on manure and kept in the dark. And that's your concern.
Absolutely, that's my concern, and that will have debilitating results in the future. Because actually, as you said, Bruce, the Reserve Bank is only able to function through credibility and its ability for us to have confidence in it and its work. And if we continue to talk about the language that continues to come out even from the Reserve Bank, then we're in trouble, unless they tell us what is really, really going on. What do they know that we don't? So that actually, you know, market players are fairly aware of what's going on, because otherwise everybody in the dark speculating will actually destroy this institution.
Antti Pai, thank you very much. Economist and founder at Nascence Advisory with our weekly Renegade Economist feature.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702 for the curious on 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show is brought to you by Nedbank, looking at money from every angle leads to better money decisions. See money differently. Nedbank. From my vantage point at the IEC Results Operating Center in Pretoria in Tswane, I can tell you that over 9 million votes have been counted so far. The capturing progress is what it's the IEC's word, capturing progress. I imagine the Guptas. The Guptas had, in the Saxon world, they had a big screen TV with capturing progress on their board.
And it had ministers on it.
And then there would have been a tally. We've got this guy, Zwane, like 100%. They would have had that. But the capturing progress at the IEC now, 59% of the votes are in. Over 5 million votes for the ANC, over 2 million votes for the DA. And the EFF on 884,000. The EFF is likely to get to at least the 10% mark. The DA lose a little bit of ground. The ANC certainly is seeing its majority being shrunk over the last while. And The Economist, which so openly endorsed Cyril Ramaphosa and saying that South Africans had to get together to back Cyril Ramaphosa as the ANC president in order to save South Africa. Their assessment this evening on their social media feed, on their Twitter feed, the ANC re-elected without much enthusiasm. And that's a very good assessment of the ANC's, where the ANC finds itself, likely to get between 57 and 58% of the national vote. Mahlatsi Mahlase is the editor-in-chief of Eyewitness News. It's a really interesting election in terms of a maturing democracy story, where you've got a political party, the lost decade, the failures of service delivery, the corruption scandals, where it hasn't been rejected outright, but the loss of enthusiasm for the ANC is profound.
It's actually profound, and they're also, even the leaders, are not celebrating. Yes, they can use the excuse that, you know, it's still counting and we don't want to speak ahead of ourselves, but just speaking to them, they are realizing that decline. There was hope that with Ramaphosa, Cyril Ramaphosa in charge, there could be a turnaround. Ambitious, yes, but they did not expect it that it will be a decline again, but more importantly, that they would still struggle in provinces like Gauteng, and all predictions are that if they hold on to Gauteng, it will just be barely just.
And I was showed the photograph this morning that Aki Anastasio posted from the Eyewitness News helicopter yesterday of the school in Soweto. I forget exactly where it was.
Deep Sloot.
It was a Deep Sloot.
Yes,
I thought it was Soweto. Okay, so yeah, Deep Sloot, the snaking queues of 1994, that a magical moment, and that same school playground today, just a dust bowl of empty, yesterday, a dust bowl of emptiness at the same sort of time as that photograph was taken in 1994. And that encapsulates voter disillusionment and the relatively low turnout, likely to be 64, maybe
65%. And I mean, the contrast to what Cyril Ramaphosa was trying to paint on election day, saying this is like the 1994 election.
Yeah, it wasn't.
But that picture, exactly, that it wasn't. And that picture said it all, that South Africans are continuing to actually stay away from the polls instead of voting against the ANC. And that is the issue. And they know that. They were quite worried about turnout in the townships because that is where the support is coming from. We had like a David Makura accepting that if the townships don't come out in their numbers, then their chances are quite low. And we've seen it again in that Deep Sloot picture showing none of those snaking queues, and actually most polling stations able to close in time, and those extended being more from a IEC logistical problems and not necessarily people's problems, tells us that people have decided to just stay away.
What's so interesting, a bit like 2016 with the local government elections, still die-hard ANC supporters, not convinced yet that Cyril Ramaphosa's got a substantial enough grip on the party to come out necessarily and support him, worried that perhaps he could be usurped at some point, worried that their vote would then enable his being booted out. That argument more and more being discounted, but maybe that was one of the reasons why people stayed away, disillusionment, waiting for the centre of the ANC maybe to regain control and to take hold once again, but not yet being willing in their droves to vote elsewhere. The EFF has taken support clearly from the ANC, but it's not in vast hordes of people deserting the ANC for others.
I think it's two ways. So yes, it's the ANC's inability to actually convince the electorate that the renewal message is actually true and for them to actually believe in it. But also it speaks to people that are just exhausted with promises that are never fulfilled. The deferred dream, as Thabo Mbeki used to actually call it. I think that's also a real contributing factor. But I think also speaks to opposition parties to say that you are still unable to capture the disillusioned ANC voter to actually come out and vote for you and punish the party. And they're deciding the punishment is just to stay at home.
In their defense, though, for opposition parties, their greatest asset was booted out.
Jacob Zuma left and they didn't know what to say.
Well, exactly. They were the dog that caught the bus.
Yes.
I mean, what happens when a dog catches a bus? Finally, because dogs chase buses down the road. Well, they catch the bus and finally find you can't eat that emblem and thing. The EFF and the DA had as their one trick each Jacob Zuma. He was taken out of the picture, and they were electorally emasculated almost.
I mean, the DA's campaign, all they could talk about was the failures of the ANC, and they still failed to even speak up their own story that they usually sell around. Look at the Western Cape, this is what we're able to sell. The gimmicks around the
They were scared about losing the Western Cape.
Yes,
I mean, there
were.
Was a real fear. I think just the look on Alan Windy's face today as it became clear that they'd managed to hold on with about 55%, it was,
thank God.
Yeah, but you look at the good party, and this is quite interesting. I mean, Patricia de Lille's good party on the national stage.
Yeah, at
the moment,
51,160.
Your eyes are good.
It's the age thing.
It's the age thing. Clearly, I need new glasses. But at 51,000 on the national stage, that doesn't explain all of the DA's decline in the Western Cape.
The true story is the Freedom Front Plus.
That is
so
the story.
That is actually the story. And we had Musi Maimane coming in earlier and actually admitting that they lost voters to the Freedom Front Plus.
Is that land? What is the issue?
It was land. I think it was land. That was part of it. And you know that the Freedom Front Plus was very strong against any chances of changing the constitution, land expropriation without compensation. They came out very strongly against it, actually using, was it Slanterig?
Slanterig, hit back.
That was actually their campaign. So I think the Conservatives that were part of the National Party decided our home is better there with the Freedom Front Plus. I think that's the first thing. But the second thing is the relationship between the DA and the EFF. It might be one that is very uncomfortable for members of the DA.
The collaboration, for example, in the city of Johannesburg in order to keep to keep the ANC out of power in those municipalities is one that uneasy alliance.
People are very uncomfortable with Julius Malema and his politics, the racialized politics, very hard talk on taking back the land. And on the other hand, you have them working together while they deny it, but they are working together with the DA. And people were very uncomfortable about that. And I think that's one of the reasons why the DA saw some of their voters going to the Freedom Front Plus. To think that the Freedom Front Plus is now possibly going to be in the top five.
Yeah.
Political parties in South Africa. So the left is growing via the EFF. Yeah. And then you've got the right, Freedom Front Plus, also growing.
But that's the marginalization of politics. But at the same time, the center remains fairly steady. Yeah. I mean, if the ANC is center and the DA is center, that's what they've become. Perhaps that's the future of cooperation. Dare we suggest it?
I think we should.
Because we've just done that.
Because if you actually think about it, that relationship between the DA and the EFF is a very difficult one for the DA. First of all, they've got a Herman Mashaba who's working very well with the EFF but in Johannesburg, but that's the only place that they're able to work well. The DA is uncomfortable with that relationship but doesn't know what to do with Herman Mashaba.
The EFF cut the throat of whiteness in Nelson Mandela Bay and ensured that Athol Trollope, who was doing a very decent job in terms of managing the budget of Nelson Mandela Bay, it was done on race.
Julius is unpredictable as well.
Yeah.
Today he's with you, tomorrow he's on the other side. But if they probably were with the ANC, there would be some form of sitting around the table and actually having a conversation.
Now, the smaller parties, the BLFs and the ATMs and all the other, the small acronyms, are fighting back in their own way, threatening electoral challenges and all sorts of stuff. It's loser speak.
Look, I don't know if it's loser speak. I think there is an acknowledgement that there are problems with our current voting system. I think that the fact that we could prove that people could actually access ballots and vote again if they wanted to is a challenge. So there is something that needs to be challenged. The results, of course, might not be affected by the few that actually managed to vote.
But there's a real concern.
There is a real concern. Yeah. There is a real concern. And they've united. They have actually united to say that they want to take the IEC on. We haven't seen the court papers yet.
Maybe they should all unite and then they can put all their votes together and then they can choose one member out of all of them.
Look,
to go to
ATM is quite happy. Jimmy Banyi. They actually made it. They've got one seat
He's not top of the list, though.
No, he's not. It doesn't mean he's going. It doesn't mean he's going, but he's actually made it. The one party that seems like will disappear is COPE. They might just make it if they do.
COPE may get one seat. COPE may get one seat. The UDM may get one or two.
They've actually passed. They're now at 51,000.
So they've got a seat.
Heading towards two.
Okay, so it's not the death of the UDM just yet.
Not yet. So the general is secured a seat. I don't know who the other one gets. Who gets the second one?
My thanks to Mahlatsi Mahlatsi this evening, the editor-in-chief of Eyewitness News. Thank you, Eyewitness News, doing a fine job of keeping you up to speed with what is happening blow by blow, moment by moment. Also, ewn.co.za. You get all of the details of what's happening in the election race. And we're live, of course, at the Results Centre.
The Money Show. Personal finance.
So I have a great vantage point here at the IEC ROC, the Results Operating Centre, at the showgrounds in Tshwane. And in my line of sight is Stephen Curtis. You'll remember him. And he's talking to Corné Mulder, the Freedom Front Plus, and he's talking to the head of the ANC elections. I want to call him by his Twitter name, but I'd get fired. Fikile Mbalula is there. And the temptation to take this tightly rolled up ball of paper and just lob it onto the set of a live TV show is overwhelming. And I'm being encouraged by, amongst others on social media, Michael Jordan and Warren Ingram. And I will not.
Come on.
Don't tempt me.
Is it Corné or Peter? I'm sure it's Peter.
It's one of the Mulders.
Peter Mulder, I can see it on the screen.
The handsome one. Yeah. Oh, can you see it?
I can see it. I would see that piece of paper. If you lobbed it, I'll be watching it on TV live.
what will you take care of my children? Because I may never be allowed to work in this town again. Now, Warren Ingram, very seriously. Now, this is, I mean, that, no big shocks, no big surprises. Growth for the EFF, stagnation for the DA, decline for the ANC. What does it mean for our money?
To me it speaks to a bit of stability in the system. So the kind of predictability of this election for the election watchers translates to market watchers, and they would look at this election and say, okay, we think that potentially what Cyril Ramaphosa has been talking about and what he wants to do has been heard by the electorate, and it's interesting, you know. So for me, the one thing here will be the magnitude of the ANC's win signals that things are going to be implemented the way he would like them to be. And I know a lot of people would comment on the loss from the previous national election, and I think that's a mistake. You should be looking at what happened from the municipal election to now on a national level, and that would be an uptick, actually. And therefore, you know, I think as an investor, I'm looking at that favorably.
Okay, well, that's positive then. So basically do nothing.
No, I didn't say that.
No. Yes.
I think it's a signal. I think there are a few more signals we need to look at. And I think the next one will be, who is in Cyril Ramaphosa's cabinet? How big is that cabinet? And yep. Who, more importantly for a lot of investors, who's out of that cabinet?
And that's a critical signal as to who's in charge.
Absolutely. And I think then, you know, aligned with that cabinet will also be the state of the nation. Remember, it will be his first cabinet. You know, because he was a caretaker of the end of the Zuma cabinet, and it will be the cabinet that he wants, and it will be the size that he wants, and then the state of the nation will be implementing the policies that he's promised. So, you know, he's spoken a lot about the fact that we have good policy already. What we need to do is implement it, and therefore the first signal to investors will be the people put in charge. You know, are they implementers, or are they just sort of, you know, the political hot air people?
I had a long chat to Enoch Godongwana this morning. He is the head of economic policy at the ANC, and he openly admits that, you know, with all of the policy in the world and all of the rules and regulations and all of the best ideas that the ANC has come up with, and for many years the ANC was a very fine implementer of economic policy. We saw that during the Manuel era and the Mbeki era. The wheels came off quite spectacularly after that. That is their greatest weakness, has been their failure to implement, in some cases, many really good and noble and potentially growth-inducing ideas. We need to get back to a point where this economy is allowed to grow, and maybe that's the point. We have to allow it to grow.
Exactly, and you know, for government to kind of get out the way and just let things happen and just create an environment for business to create jobs, because that's really who's going to create the jobs. It's not going to be politicians, it's going to be business people creating businesses and growing their businesses and employing more people. And for that to happen, they just need a bit of stability, and they just need government to stop shooting business people in the foot.
Yeah.
And so to my next concern will be how state-owned enterprises are funded.
Yep.
And most importantly, Eskom, and things, you know, scary things need to disappear, like prescribed assets, and we need to find a rational way for funding that. One hopes that Cyril's applied some of his mind to that, and that we will hear about this and see proper steps taken. And it's going to take a long time, for example, to turn a place like Eskom around. And so I'm not expecting that by December this year it's all done and everything's hunky-dory. What I'm expecting is how quickly, post-announcement of his cabinet, steps are taken, that not just talk, you know, but actually this is the first step. Here's the first concrete step, breaking up Eskom. We've done it, here it is, and we've started the process.
I'm looking forward to the President's first State of the Nation address, which I think is scheduled for a couple of weeks' time. Once Parliament resits and once the President is re-elected, he then gives his first State of the Nation address. It'll be the second this year, but I expect it to be a far more forthright and far stronger statement than what was the first decent State of the Nation address South Africa's seen in years in February this year.
Yeah, and I have no critique of that February one. I think you asked me my opinion on air, and I said it was fine. You know, I think it was a much like the budget, you know, difficult thing to do. But
we need to go beyond fine, though, correct?
Correct. And now we need concrete announcements, concrete steps announced in this State of the Nation, and real action to be taken. That's not populist, you know. That's not just out there to kind of make every bit of every faction in the ANC happy. Now we need to say our sole focus is on getting the economy right and creating jobs for our people, because that's, you know, forget ideology, that's what we need to do now. And
yeah.
And so,
okay, we look at the Ramaphoric style rally that we've seen so far this year, this 13-40% increase on the JSE, excluding the sharp pullback we saw today, of course, as a result of what's going on in international markets with Donald Trump and the Chinese at each other's throats over the future of trade tariffs. South Africa, is it more investable today than it was 6 months ago? Is it more investable today than it was during the dying days of the Zuma administration?
Absolutely. I mean, not even a question in my mind. I think, that's really why, for me, someone like me who hates politics, why I have to talk about it now, because what we need...
It is true. Yes, you do go green. Yeah.
And now what we're looking for is just for this stuff to get out of the way and for us to not have to talk about it on a money show. You know, we need to be talking about...
Money.
Money and the economy and business and all of those things. And when you've got, kind of political haters like me talking about it, it tells you that we spend too much time as a country on politics and bad policy and obstruction of good business and not enough time on the rest. So I will be watching that State of the Nation, the second one I've ever watched in my life, after February, and I'll be looking for real concrete steps. And then my last real big thing that I'll be looking for is the whole resolution of land expropriation. Not that I'm hoping it goes away, but that I'm hoping it gets resolved, that it becomes explicit policy.
Explicit policy in which South Africans feel like they've got a fair chance, a fair shake, a fair stake in the future. You don't have to, it's not a case of the great big national giveaway. It's a case of how do we make South Africa a fairer place in which to live. You make South Africa fairer, you make South Africa sustainable, you make South Africa sustainable, you make it investable, you make it a place in which there can be investment and growth, you create jobs, and hopefully people get on a bit better.
Yeah, and it's something that you can do in a very in a kind of a very business friendly environment as well. So it's not that there should be, at the end of this that there is one whole segment of the South African population who are losers. It should be one of those where everybody might feel slightly happy or slightly unhappy, but at the end there isn't kind of a major swing to a particular direction. You know, we need to create certainty. We need to create a fairer economic system. That's absolutely true, but we shouldn't be seen to be taking things away. You know, this should be a case of how do we build and create more opportunities and give people more access to economic wealth.
Next week we'll talk about personal finance. Warren Ingram from Galileo Capital, thank you very much indeed. He is our
throw
personal
that paper.
Finance expert. Oh, it's tempting. No. Get thee behind me, Satan.
The Money Show. Small business.
On to small business now, and Pablo is out today, so we're getting two entrepreneurs that we respect, and we respect them enough to make them part of the Solutionist Thinking podcast series. Tracy Chambers, who's chief executive of the Clothing Bank, was one of the guests in series number one, and Katlego Mapai, the chief executive officer at Yoko, is in our second series of Solutionist Thinking. Both great interviews and great stories, but I'm interested today about their post-election views of South Africa as operators of small and rapidly growing businesses in South Africa. What do you make, Katlego Mapai, chief executive of Yoko, about the way in which this election has been conducted and the way in which the results are coming in?
Hi, Bruce. Very happy to be on the show and talking about small business. First and foremost, I think it's fantastic that the elections have gone on, relatively smooth. It's nice to get another election under the belt. And importantly, to move past this, we saw with small businesses, as we surveyed them, that the topic of elections and all the political uncertainty was fairly top of mind for them. And now, really, it's a case of moving on and really playing a meaningful role in helping to grow the economy.
Okay, so what do you see as your role then? I mean, you're in the payment space. Your payment devices, the Yoko devices, are ever more present in small business environments. Lots of people are using them. How do you see yourself making a contribution in this desperately needed space of small businesses growing and creating jobs? I think you're employing about 130 people at the moment, but your technology is empowering entrepreneurs to also employ people.
Exactly. So we have over 41,000 businesses on the Yoko platform nationwide right now. Having a card machine is so fundamental in the country. There are about 75-80% of consumers that have cards in their pockets. And the reality is that consumers who have cards tend to spend more. And that translates into more revenue for these smaller businesses. So you know, getting into this growth curve, getting into a proper cycle, having a card facility plays an important role for this to happen. And this is something that we're really hoping to facilitate by really focusing on onboarding business owners who are previously operating only in cash and bringing them into the digital space. And then next to that, as our community of small businesses grows, you know, 41,000 strong, we really see ourselves now as being a collective voice for small business. And there are really some important things that we need to highlight, and we put this out in our latest research. So first and foremost, the topic of load shedding really hit small business very hard in Q1. You know, we saw in Q3 and Q4 last year quite a bit of positivity and growth and a sense of optimism. But, you know, when the load shedding hit in Q1, this was really dashed. And it was the first time since we started conducting our survey that we started seeing a drop-off in sentiment from small business. So, you know, on the topic of power security and load shedding, the government really needs to get on top of this. And if there are still challenges, we need to find a way to provide incentives or support to small business to ensure that they can keep the lights on.
I mean, large corporations can make alternative plans. They may not like having to spend the shareholders' money on big photovoltaic plates on the roof or on massive generators. But the point is they can. The vast majority of small businesses shut their doors. The zip machines don't work. I mean, the hairdressers, clippers don't work if the centres they're in don't have backup. And they don't earn revenue for 4 hours at a time, twice a day. That's 8 hours of lost business every single day for a period of time. That kills small business.
Correct, Bruce. And small business are the majority of employers in this country. And, you know, it's a double hit, right? You're first suffering from a loss of revenue, and now you're having to spend extra scarce capital that you basically don't have on having to get alternative sources of power. So I really believe that, you know, the government has to pay very close attention to this and really play a role and come up with some sort of a mechanism to support small business if there's another power crunch that comes.
Yeah, I mean, and it feels almost inevitable that that will occur. I mean, here is the real issue for South Africa is we just have so little faith in the ability of the state to provide those basic services to us. And a lot of people will be apprehensive until there's a clearer picture in terms of the state's ability to do that simple job, and that is energy security. And while there is uncertainty, people don't invest. People hold back, Katleho. We, as a country and small business, needs a desperate confidence boost.
Indeed we do, and I think the way we do this is by coming together. You know, how does a set of small businesses within a community or within a locale or within a street come together to see how they can collaborate on power generation, for instance? I really think by folks coming together, sharing ideas, there is a way in which we can overcome this, and we have to. It's really fundamental.
It's non-negotiable. I mean, without energy security, we're on a hiding to nothing. I mean, are you a more optimistic South African, Katleho, today than perhaps you were 3 months ago? How are you feeling?
I definitely am. You know, there's a lot of fundamental shifts that could have happened during this election. We are definitely seeing the rise of populism, both on the left and on the right. But for the most part, you know, moderation has come through. And I think that's going to really give a strong sense of stability in terms of what goes forward. You know, if the current president of the ANC, the president of the current country, Cyril Maphosa, is able to really push through with his agenda of growth, we have a strong chance. And also what I'd like to see is really a strong push towards opening up the economy. I still see the economy is being fairly closed in terms of how capital moves in and out, regulation, access to components of the economy that are quite limited to larger businesses, and also just the cost of compliance and the legal fees that come with that. I think it's really important that we move to a context where we're simplifying, and there's so much that can be done through just the unlocking of policy. Versus things that make things a lot more onerous and subsequently cut out small business.
Katlego Mapai, always a pleasure to have you. Thank you so much. Solutionist thinker, Katlego Mapai, chief executive at Yoko. If you go to our Solutionist Thinking podcast series, just ask Siri to take you there or go to your podcast app and listen to a fabulous story of a great South African startup, collaboration between mates from university, people within the telecoms industry, and disrupting the financial services industry in a very serious way. Another disruptor is Tracy Chambers, chief executive at the Clothing Bank. She's next.
The Money Show is brought to you by Nedbank. Looking at money from every angle leads to better money decisions. See money differently. Nedbank.
Good evening and welcome to The Money Show, live from the Results Center in Pretoria, where we have been broadcasting from for the last 2 days. A really fascinating array of people that have gathered here today to start looking at the leaderboards, to start watching the prospects of their parties. Many resigned. 15 political parties have agreed to collaborate to file court papers against the IEC to do investigations into whether or not there was any substantial malfeasance when it comes to double or quadruple voting. That is a real concern amongst the smaller parties who, if you're going to be honest about it, you have to look at them and say, you went nowhere. It's not like you've achieved massive voter support yourselves. This hasn't destabilized you. This hasn't undermined you. If you think other parties have cheated, well, that's a different thing. But that's not going to improve your result. It seems like sour grapes amongst parties that simply didn't have a hope in the world of making any substantial gains. And it's really gratifying to see some of the more outlandish political parties not make gains. It just goes to show that South Africans are very sensible people, ultimately. And that's comforting for all of us. Tracy Chambers is chief executive at the Clothing Bank as we do our small business feature this evening. Tracy Chambers, I'm sure you don't want to talk politics, but stable politics is ultimately good because it allows you to carry on doing the good work that you do in sourcing clothing from retailers who want people to buy their clothes, but if they don't, they donate them to you. You then put them into a central repository and help startup entrepreneurs sell these clothes in informal markets and thereby create, what, more than 3,500 businesses so far?
Absolutely. Hi, Bruce. Thanks for having me again.
Absolute pleasure. How are things going with the Clothing Bank?
Well, Bruce, we've had the most incredible year. We've reached our target of supporting 1,000 business owners in any given year. And this year, our traders made over 44 million rand in profit. Our sales are up by 32%.
Amazing.
So it seems like small business is thriving.
Well, that's
even
good news
on political uncertainty.
Yeah, I mean, that's good news on that front. And when we did our Solutionist Thinking podcast interview with you, you made the observation, and a very real observation, that so many of these women who you're seeking to help would go home to households where their husbands might be unemployed, where their husbands might be disillusioned, where their husbands may be really, really struggling with their lot in the world. And you were looking to partner, I think, with Clicks to get electronics into the system and to help men in townships also start up small businesses. Has that got off the ground?
Yes, absolutely, Bruce. We've now had the Appliance Bank project, which has been running for about 3 years. We have partnerships with Clicks, ShopRite Checkers, and Home of Living Brands. It's just one of the biggest importers of small appliances in South Africa. It's not going as well as we'd hoped, mainly because we've got constrained supply. But I think what we've realized is how important it is to bring men into the conversation in South Africa. Men are certainly feeling disenfranchised. And a man without hope, you know, his ego suffers, and he expresses that in different ways to women. So I think it's really important that we take care of the men in the economy. And once a man is able to provide for his family, you know, he really is, everything changes about him. So we currently help about 70 men, and those men made about 3.3 million rand in profits. But we certainly believe that we have a model that we can grow and support men in the way they need to be supported.
And you, again, operating in the communities that you do, you see the needs, you see the opportunities, you hopefully manage to find the opportunities that exist within communities. And I mean, one of the biggest crises facing South Africa today, of course, is education.
Yeah, Bruce, thanks so much. We identified that need about 4 years ago and started a very small pilot where I was seeing that women who were starting to gain wealth in their lives knew that quality education was the key out of poverty for their families, and that's what they were seeking for their children. And so they were transporting their children great distances at great expenses to seek education, quality education, because they just couldn't find it in their communities. And so we started a project called Grow Educare Centres in 2014 and said that we could bring outstanding quality education into disadvantaged communities. And if we could do that, that parents who were aspiring for quality would be prepared to pay for it. And we've proven that they are, and they can save significantly on transport. So we started a social franchise model. We now have 32 centres. And because people are paying for that service, we are able to offer sustainable business opportunities to the women running those centres. And we really believe that this is the model that South Africa needs. If we know that early learning has lifelong benefits for children, that's a given. All the science has proved that. We now need to find a way, which we believe franchising can do, to give every woman running an early learning center in disadvantaged communities a recipe to make it a high quality education center. It doesn't help that we've just got education centers. They need to offer outstanding quality. Great. We've got a recipe to do that. And we now have 32 centers. We want to make that thousands of centers. And we're on the way to scaling that quite rapidly over the next couple of years.
Are you coming up against any donor fatigue? Are you coming up against corporates that are saying, Tracy, lovely ideas, you're very persistent, you're very committed, you're implementing brilliantly, but you're exhausting us. Could you please back off and go pick on someone else for a change? Are you finding any of that, or do you find a corporate environment hugely receptive to the work that you're doing?
I think corporate South Africa is coming closer and closer to understanding that if we don't solve inequality in this country, that their company won't thrive, and that there's a direct relationship between inequality and shareholder return. I think 20 years ago, those two were, you know, there was no understanding that the two were interlinked. So I think if you come to the boardroom table with solutions that solve those kind of problems, we have found that the doors only open. I think every South African is concerned about where our country's at, and I think if you're offering a solution to improve inequality and give everybody, you know, fight for social justice for everybody, they certainly are open to listening.
Do you feel like you're making significant inroads?
Certainly, we're making inroads. We'd love to go faster. We'd love to have more impact, as in not thousands, as in hundreds of thousands.
Yeah.
But we certainly got a formula that works, and I think it really is about how many people can get behind us to scale that model as fast as we can.
If you had one wish, if there was a wish fairy on the Money Show tonight, or a wish fairy listening, what would be the one thing that would benefit considerably to getting you the scale, closer to the sort of scale, maybe not in the hundreds of thousands, but maybe getting you towards a 10,000 impact point?
So we, certainly for our Grow social franchise model, our early learning social franchise model, we would like every corporate in South Africa, big or small, to adopt one ECD center. And then we could have thousands of high-quality ECD centers. It's simple. It talks to the full BEE scorecard in terms of enterprise development points, which are some of the hardest points to gain, and you get to help a small business thrive, and you get to help children thrive. So that would be my one wish, that every corporate has one ECD that they sponsor, help a woman, help a child to thrive, and help a woman to thrive. And I think we could solve so many of our challenges, because it all starts with education.
An uplifting thought this evening to wrap up the Money Show. Thank you, Tracy Chambers. All the best in your continuing good work. I mean, they've done an amazing, she and the other Tracy, two Tracys got together one day, depressed about the state of the nation, despairing about the lot of women, looking at the companies in which they work. Tracy Chambers worked for Woolworths and saw, she was in the accounts department, and saw that they were throwing away at the end of season clothes and they were trashing them, putting them into landfill, and said, hold on a second, can we not repurpose this? Can we not take this work, this clothing? It's no threat to the retail supply chain. And allow women to buy these clothes from us, teach them how to run the business, to put the markup on the clothes, to create their own businesses. And the stories that Tracy tells on that Solutionist Thinking podcast interview from the first series is nothing short of remarkable. We're saying, if the why doesn't make you cry, then you're not doing enough. It's a fabulous and very simple philosophy. But Tracy Chambers, incredible work at the clothing bank. And also to Katlego Mapai, chief executive at Yoko this evening, two very committed South African entrepreneurs looking to change the world for the good.
The Money Show is brought to you by Nedbank. Looking at money from every angle leads to better money decisions. See money differently. Nedbank.
Well, the road ahead becoming clearer and clearer by the minute as more and more votes are counted. 62% of the votes are counted now. Nearly 62% of the votes are counted. Karima, keep you up to speed with that. And, of course, Leicester and Cape Town keeping you up to speed with what's happening in the Western Cape as well. That is it from The Money Show for this evening. Thank you so much for listening. Good night.